Welcome back to Following Noah Donna Stormlight Podcast. This episode is episode 201 of the podcast. Elliot, how are you?
I am doing really well. We're starting a new Brandon Sanderson book, which is always exciting. I'm always very curious what the next story is going to hold for us, what Brandon has cooked up for us. And the way this book has been explained to me, when I mentioned to somebody that, oh, we're starting Bands of Mourning, I got a very wide-eyed stare, and the person said, that book blew my mind. So now,
really? Okay.
I have very high expectations, curiosity going into this. I don't know what to expect.
Paul, how are you?
Fantastic. Yeah, starting this book off, I should mention that I've been, skeptical, unenthusiastic, I feel like, about Mistborn Era 2 thus far. But I have a feeling that this book is gonna turn that around for me a bit. Already I'm pretty engaged from the get-go. So I'm enjoying it. I'm excited to dive deeper into it with y'all, of course.
So there's nothing official about this book, but how I feel about it is this book and then the next three that we'll be covering on the podcast, which will then put us Cosmere Current. But starting with this book and then into those next three really puts you guys Cosmere Current. Like anything that any secrets that the fans know that you guys don't, starting with this book, you guys are going to be learning quite a bit, which we start, right off the bat in this episode. So let's roll intro, and then we'll be talking about prologue through chapter 4, all of part 1 of the Bands of Mourning. A fun fact, gentlemen, when we started this podcast, I was reading Bands of Mourning for the first time. So 4 years ago, at the time when we were beginning The Way of Kings, I was trying to imagine that when we'd be reading the Bands of Mourning, and I had no concept of what time frame we'd be looking at. If you told me 4 years later, I'd be like, oh man, that's a long time.
I was about to ask, did you foresee 4 years as that time frame?
I doubt it. I don't even know if I fully had a grasp of how long getting through Oathbringer and Rhythm of War would be. And then, starting on the rest of the Cosmere, I wasn't even, trying to time frame that. Elliot, can you summarize the prologue through chapter 4 for those of our listeners who haven't read it recently?
I certainly can. So the Bands of Mourning starts off with another prologue from Wax's past. And we pick up with him as young teenager, maybe.
Yeah, no Lessie this time.
No Lessie this time that I noticed. And he's with the Terrace people. He's growing up with Grandma, I forget what they call her. Grandma V or something like
Grandma
that?
Grandma V is what they call her, which is what you gave her the moniker of before they called her that on the book.
Well, her name was Fossendahl. Yeah, that. Her name was near impossible to pronounce. So anyway, Wax is growing up with the Terrace with Grandma V, and he doesn't fit in very well. He's not making a lot of friends. He's not feeling like he belongs there, although his sister is there with him, and she does appear to be fitting in and getting along. There's one particular boy that Wax does not get along with. His name is Forch, I guess. Forch?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Wax is very suspicious of him, thinks he's up to no good, tries to turn him into the police. The police are like, we should investigate this. Grandma V says, nope, we got this handle, leave us alone. And then Wax catches the dude red-handed, literally torturing someone or performing some kind of magical ceremony on them. It was a little graphic and a little terrifying, actually, what Wax stumbles into and then has a bit of a showdown with the dude. So yeah, we're right into the thick of it with Bands of Mourning. Chapter one picks up with Wax's wedding day. So Wax and Steris are getting married. But of course, this is Wax and Wayne, so it doesn't go to plan, and a water tower gets dumped on top of them. Of course, Steris being Steris has planned for every possible contingency, so when Wax forgets the pendants, which I'm guessing are the equivalent of rings, she's got extras. When the wedding tower or when the water tower ruins the whole day, she's got a backup venue booked a month from now. She's got everything handled. We find out in chapter two that Wayne, who was conspicuously absent from the wedding, was the one that dumped the water tower on them during the wedding. And he and Marcy have a little bit of a heart-to-heart about things. And then the Chondra show up again and want Wax's help with investigating some things. Wax wants nothing to do with it, but eventually gets sucked in. We get a very interesting lecture about investiture and some other magic system-y type stuff, and then they get ready to set off on a new adventure. I think that's all part one.
Very nice, very nice. Yes, for the first time in a Cosmere book, we get quite literally sat down in a chair and given a presentation slideshow on fortune, connection, investiture, and identity. And the last two more specific than the first two. But
and full stop there, my favorite chapter of Mistborn Era 2 by far, hands down. give me that lore, baby. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. This is what I've been wanting. This is what I've been missing. Finally, I'm getting it.
Yeah. And there's some like specific details in Mistborn Era 1 that you kind of just accept as, you know, just part of the story that are like specifically spelled out in this slideshow, specifically how the Lord Ruler's bands work and how he divested himself of identity before creating the Bands of Mourning. And then also the metal that Elend finds at the Well of Ascension to create him, to give him Mistborn powers. That's also maybe defined in this chapter. So we get some cool teasers there. Paul, what did you think of the prologue? It seems to be like a pretty normal chapter. Everything like Wax is, you know, 15. He's got a crush on this girl. And then he walks into the wrong building and there's a 5-year-old strung up, about ready to be killed. Like, it just goes from 0 to 100 so fast.
It does go, it ramps up really quick. But I really loved this prologue. And that's why I briefly mentioned earlier that I'm hoping that this book is kind of the switch that flips for me to really love Era 2. And I think that's going to be the case. And I think it starts with this. The reason I actually really love this prologue is not necessarily just because of the quick ramp up and kind of the drama, the like craziness of it, but actually it poses a very, I guess, difficult ethical dilemma for Wax as a younger, you know, teen young man. And then we see him kind of move on from that. And I feel like that gave me a really clear picture of a really clear view of Wax now. He's posed with this like ethical dilemma of, do I try to enact justice on my friend or colleague who I know is doing wrong? Or do I abide by the rules of our group? He's with the terrorist people. Do I abide by the rules that Grandma V has of, like, you know, you report it, but we will handle it, and we'll handle it our way, which is different from, I feel like, what you'd normally think of like, laws and punishments and crimes and jail or things like that. You know, it's all different with the terrorists, to where Wax probably feels that it's not safe for... Maybe that the punishment doesn't fit the crime or isn't stopping potential future criminal activity or whatever. It poses an interesting question, I feel like, in Wax's mind, and mine is the reader. And then I feel like the fast forward at the end of that is, I after that, I was thinking back to the previous two books that we've read of Wax referring back some to his Terrace heritage, and just how he does things differently. He's viewed by Grandma V current day as like taking things too rashly and taking lives and things like that. But I feel like he's really set out to find, I guess, what's right and do the hard thing. And I guess it's still kind of wishy-washy on what the answer is, but I feel like it gave me a clear picture of Wax today of where he is. He kind of loathes the lack of, I guess, action taken with the Terrace, you know, i.e. this flashback. But also, is it just like wanting to, he's not like bloodthirsty to kill people, right? You know, there's kind of a balance with them, I guess. And so I thought that was a really interesting, I guess, juxtaposition brought up at the start of the book, which I really enjoyed. And then also it was just neat to see the flashback. It was kind of neat to have that and not have Lessie, you know, no harm, no foul towards Lessie, but it was neat to get this other perspective, I guess. So all in all, I really enjoyed it. And to answer your question now, actually, Trevor, it did absolutely go really quick of like, I was waiting to see how maybe Grandma V or whoever would handle the situation. And then Wax really stumbles into like the wrong place and is really confronted. The only thing that kept me from thinking he might die in there was knowing we are following himself like current day. And this is a flashback. It was a really like convincing. It was a really well-written prologue, really packed. So yeah, all in all, I'm glad you asked because that was probably, this was definitely one of my favorite chapters of Era 2 by far. I loved it.
Nice. I think you summed that up really well. Elliot, at the end of the chapter of the prologue, Forge and Wax are suspending a bullet between them with their steel pushing. Both of them are steel pushers.
Yep.
And Wax then differentiates the three parts of the bullet in his mind and then specifically pushes on the hammer or the, I don't know. Is that correct? Where the hammer would hit.
Yeah.
And so pushes that and artificially fires the bullet into Forsh. Is that cool or is that like kind of a scapegoat answer?
It's very cool. I didn't question it in the moment. When I thought back on it later, I did, my skeptical face came on slightly. And I'm actually, not an expert in firearms by any means, hence why I don't know what the term is for what you're describing, even though I know what it is. But yeah, exploding a bullet on its own, suspended in midair, does that actually propel it in the direction that you want it to go? Maybe. It probably does, at least a little bit. Probably not nearly as forcefully as when you have a gun with a barrel that channels all that energy, gives the bullet something to push against with it, which is you holding the gun. Right. So the gun recoils and then pushes the bullet in the other direction if you don't have that recoil. But I guess if they're pushing on it with their ferrochemie, maybe that.
I think the important part is the pressure of the barrel. What actually makes the bullet go forward is you're building up pressure. If you just fire that bullet without any pressure,
right,
like, the bullet's still suspended.
It's going to be more of a mini explosion.
I think there'd be more shrapnel than is actually in this chapter, but we'll give it a pass, I suppose.
Yeah. I don't know for sure. I think it's the bullet casing. I think that's the word we're looking for, maybe.
No.
Part of the bullet. I could be wrong.
There's three parts of the bullet, and they say this in the chapter. There's the casing, the ham, or the casing, the front of it, part. And then there's that back stud or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, anyway.
I took it as cool, not like a scapegoat or anything. It felt legit. It felt kind of reminiscent to what isn't there a part in Mistborn Era 1 where Ven like pushes back on arrows or something that shot at her? I could be wrong, but I feel like that was the case, or like redirects or something like that.
She specifically designs ring arrows that like, and Elliot had a little visual of this
presentation where, about it. Yes.
Yeah. Where you,
that's what I'm
you
thinking.
You throw an arrow at someone and then when they push back, they only slide the ring off the back of the arrow and the arrow still is flying forward.
Yes. That's what I'm thinking of. I feel like it's a similar-ish mechanic. Definitely not exact, but it felt reminiscent of that type of thing to me. So I thought it was clever. I thought it was neat. I had no qualms about it, at least.
I was less bothered by the bullet firing shenanigans and more bothered by the extremely random final two pages of the prologue. We go through this whole Terrace backstory, which, yes, very cool, lots of good information. I love, by the way, how Paul, you tied that to modern day Wax. I didn't actually think too much about that, but you're absolutely right. This could be a key part of why he believes in the law so much, why he's the lawman. It's because he's been through times like this where the law was not correctly applied and he's seen the consequences of that.
Right.
Anyway, we go through all that, resolve that, and then it says something like 28 years later, scene cut, and we just drop in on this random, like, Wax and Wayne are fighting bad guys in an alley for an entirety of 100 words, and then the prologue ends and you cut to chapter one, which is the same day as that final two pages. Why in the world is that in the prologue and not just the first two pages of chapter one? Any literary people out there want to explain to me why Brandon did that?
I guess he wanted to end the prologue with "It's my wedding day," and then chapter one is like him walking into the church. But I don't know. Maybe I have no good answer for you. I suppose
I'm afraid I don't either. I'm no idea.
Especially the beginning sequence, like the first two chapters of this book feels like Pixar's The Incredibles to me, where he's going on this sting operation to get these bandits the day of his wedding, and he shows up. And his wife is fully expecting him to be late, but not quite that late. And, you know, I just had a very vivid image of the beginning of The Incredibles, which is one of my favorite movies. It's a very good movie. I just needed to say it.
That's a really good comparison. The vigilante kind of behavior and right. Showing up late to the wedding, you know, crashing your own wedding. That's pretty spot on.
All right. The wedding does not commence. Wax is kind of like freaking out at the altar. So he's trying to like look around to distract himself, looks up at the building across because it's like a glass ceiling so you can see the mists or whatever, sees a water tower falling on their heads, and then jump to the next chapter. Wayne is responsible. He's hired some saboteurs to disrupt the wedding, and Wayne has stopped the wedding. And then Marcy and Wayne, this is like our first scene with Marcy in the book. Wayne specifically tells Marcy, "Yo, you should move on Wax before he marries Steris." And it's kind of like been hinted at, like that kind of relationship between Marcy and Wax, but this is the first time it was expressly said by any character, I think, that Wayne straight up says, "Yo, they almost got married. I disrupted it for you. You need to move if you want to marry Wax." And by the end of the scene, Marcy is pretty explicit this, and she says, "I'm no longer interested." But what did you guys think of Wayne disrupting Wax and Stairs' wedding.
We wondered from the very beginning if we were going to get love triangle. And we haven't really. It's kind of been implied. It's kind of been touched on, but Stairs hasn't had a whole lot of screen time, so we haven't gotten a lot of drama about it. This is full-on drama, like sabotaging a wedding so that you can get the other girl in on the relationship. We are very much in love triangle territory at this point. But I gotta say, I'm highly disappointed in Wayne for this moment. Wayne is supposed to be Wax's best friend. They are buddies. They got each other's back. They do a lot of shenanigans, but when it comes down to it, they cover for each other. They protect each other. They're there for each other. Sabotaging your bro's wedding? Whether you support the girl or not? Really? Really? That seems like a cross a line that Wayne, not even Wayne, usually crosses. That was surprising to me.
What's funny for me is that I was going to say this feels like a typical Wayne moment.
Contrast. Yeah, it's a new level of Wayne. You got to admit that, right? This is like sabotaging an entire wedding. That's a big deal.
I agree. I'm not saying it's not, you know, across a line that shouldn't have been crossed. Definitely was. But I feel like, I don't know. So you're right. This is definitely set up the love triangle here has been implied, but not really. There's not been a lot that's been done with it, I feel like, so far. I feel like we're led to root for Marcy because all that we've seen from Stairs is very rigid and awkward and doesn't feel natural. Doesn't feel like a natural romantic fit. It's the, you know, strategic, the political wedding, you know? And so, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of fitting for this to be delayed, but it almost feels a little bit like, oh, I forgot to really flesh out the whole, you know, romance triangle. So the wedding can't happen yet, I guess, to carry on suspension for it and add to it and things like that. So it felt a bit funny. It felt, yeah, I think that's the one thing that has felt funny to me, I guess, of like, yeah, okay, the wedding's delayed now because we're still holding on to the question of like who will Wax be with. Anyways, but I will say, I did mention that I feel like we're led to root for Marcy. I could be wrong. People may have not felt that way, but we are getting a lot more. We're getting more Stairs input. We kind of get them at the very end of the previous book. And some, you know, conversations in this book. And that's what I've been waiting for, I guess, for this specifically. Is like, I just need to see more from Stairs. Like, we need to flesh her out more. Because if not, then I don't know. It's almost setting her up like fodder to die strategically for the story or something. Of like having this character who you're introduced to, but not really fleshed out too much. I guess so you don't get too attached. I don't know. So it's felt a bit funny, but all in all, I guess that's what we're going to start seeing a lot more of is this love triangle, or it almost feels like it's just starting to set Stairs up to be the rightful romance interest, you know?
Do you have any predictions? Do you think Wax and Stairs will end up together by the end of the book, by the end of Air 2? Do you think Marcy still has a shot? Do you think she wants a shot?
After seeing this, I'm taking this as an indicator of the trajectory of where we're going. So I think that we are going to see Wax and Stairs together by the end. And I think it may just grow a bit more legitimate and romantic, I guess, by the end of it. Because right now it's fairly, you know, forced and a bit awkward and stuff. So I think we'll get there, though. That's my prediction.
I agree with that prediction for a kind of different reason. I think Wax will end up with Steris, or more specifically, I think Wax will not end up with Marcy. I think that's my prediction, because I think the story arc that Marcy is on is she's kind of on a journey to prove that she doesn't need Wax. That's her story. Her story is living in the shadow of the heroes and finding that she can contribute on her own. These chapters already start to get into some of that, where the Chondra come to her, and at first she's all feeling good about that. Oh, wow, you want me to help with your quest? And then Wax shows up and goes, wait, you went to her? And like the hurt that, you know, she feels in that moment of, well, what do you mean? And you don't think I can go on your quest for you? All of that feels like it's setting up this. Marcy needs to discover the value that she can add, and that she can be a hero in and of herself, and that she doesn't need Wax. To have her marry Wax, not sure that fits into that story arc. Maybe it does. Maybe our story has some twists and turns in it. There's more pages in this book than there were in the previous ones. So maybe there's some twists and turns, character development I'm not foreseeing here, but a Marcy Wax wedding partnership does not seem to make sense to me for where these characters are going.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, you highlighted it, but we can go ahead and jump into it. Vendel, a new Chondra character, attends Wax's wedding, tries to pull him aside unsuccessfully. Wax says, absolutely not, especially today. He's still mad at Harmony. He's still mad at the Chondra. And he's trying to commit himself to the moment, be there for Steris, because he knows how much it means to her. And so Vendel seemingly honors that request and then goes to Marcy, but as Wax and maybe Marcy kind of seem to hint at during that scene, it might just be Vendel going with option two to try to rope Wax in, because they really actually do need Wax. So getting Marcy on board has a pretty high probability of getting Wax involved, so which is what ends up happening. So Vendel gives us a slideshow on investiture and identity, and we get those two phrases said more in this chapter than I think we have in the entire Cosmere up until this point. So what did you guys learn about investiture and identity and allomancy and ferrochemy and all sorts of cool new rules? Or old rules that were newly explained.
I got a gleam in my eye as soon as they started into the conversation. I think the chapter before this ends with like the last sentence of chapter two is Vendel saying to Marcy, "What do you know about investiture and identity?" And I was like, "Yes, I'm reading the next chapter right now. Let's go. Please explain these things to me. I think I know what investiture is, but I'd love to learn more." Identity. We've seen this term before. It's been snuck into a few different books here and there without enough context to know like what exactly it's talking about. In like Stormlight specifically, there's a fair amount of words that get capitalized for seemingly random reasons. There's words like Shallan's memory that are capitalized, and you're kind of like, oh, is that magic? Is that not magic? Are we just supposed to pay attention to that? I think identity is one of those. I think we've come across it before, capitalized, and just kind of wondered, am I just supposed to notice that? Is that something special? But then earlier in this Era 2 series, we've gotten the, is it called Ars Arcanum in the back? Yeah.
Yeah.
Ars Arcanum, starting with the first one, Alloy of Law. Mm-hmm. There was a bunch of information back there that was not really addressed in that book, but we didn't really have context for. It spells out quite a bit of metals and what they do, both for allomancy and ferrochemy, and some of them talk about identity. And I saw that in the back of Alloy of Law. I was like, identity. What do you mean identity as a magic system? What does that mean? So I've been on the lookout for somebody to explain to me what they mean by identity, and this chapter does it, which I thought was super cool. And I want to talk about some of it with you guys, but what were some of your guys' initial impressions on the lecture I'm going to teach you about magic scene?
I can agree with you, Elliot, of feeling like the desire to, okay, yeah, I'm tuned in. I want to read more. I want to see more. I didn't know about it in the Ars Arcanum. That has me thinking, before I say any more, that has me thinking of, you know, where else are we going to see this? What else are we going to learn about it? Yeah, I'm with identity specifically, I'm kind of waiting more for like the application. But yeah, long story short, I feel like this has really just begun to set up the way I was really hoping that maybe even the previous book would have set up more of like explaining more of the magic nuances at hand and seeing more from characters like Steris and all the things that are kind of being set up now and perspective into Wax's character and also, which we have got that. But anyways, all in all, I really enjoyed this. I was really excited. This was one of those moments where I was excited to hear from y'all, excited to obviously discuss. 'Cause while talking about the narrative of what's going on is really fun and absolutely love, talking about this stuff is now probably takes the cake, is most exciting, you know.
I've converted you, Paul. I've converted you.
Yeah. I guess, you know, they say you're the sum of a lot of your closest friends. You know, I think I'm definitely getting more, you know. I've always enjoyed lore, but, you know, I was a sucker for the action scenes, and maybe now it's changing. I will always have this. The Zeth action scenes, though, will always take the cake, though, I must say.
Yeah, as a genre of scene, like the Council of Elrond, how do, let's sit down and talk about the quest.
Plan. Yeah.
Right, before we go do it. How do those rank for you usually, Paul? Like, are those growing on you, or like this scene specifically is a lot of that. We're going to sit down and we're going to talk.
So I vividly remember being young and still really enjoying the Council of Elrond, whereas that in a lot of... I always love when all the heroes are kind of in the same room, you know, like the scene where it's not an Avengers Assemble scene where it's like in the midst of action, but like the setting off and all the heroes are condensed into one space getting to discuss. I think that's pretty epic. Council of Elrond is definitely really up there still. Whereas in general, the like strategic slower sides aren't typically my favorite. I'm a sucker for the like the action and the twists and the reveals and stuff like that. But yeah, that archetype, I guess, Council of Elrond, that sort of thing here it's definitely grown as well. Like, you know, now I think what it comes down to is how much fruit is there in the details like that. If it's, I mean, I don't want to rag on any, you know, thing, but I'm like, if this were the case for, I don't know, I'm going to pick one. And if this offends, I'm very sorry. Star Wars. If it was like a group of Jedi playing, so that's actually a tough one because I like the Jedi Masters and their, you know, mini stuff. But you get the picture. If it's like they're planning and or there's like a lot of emphasis in little details, it's much less rewarding. But especially with Sanderson, he does such a great job of all that being very rewarding. Learning about identity and fortune or whatever, investiture, is far more rewarding than little details in other stories. So I didn't pick a good example, so.
What about you, Elliot? Did you struggle through the Council of Elrond on your first time? Do you remember?
No. I think I read that book 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So, for the first time. So I don't remember. But lore scenes in general, if you haven't learned this about me yet, are the favorites for me. And I think you need the balance. You still need the plot. You need the action scene. You need the dialogue to balance it out. If a book was nothing but lecture, then it's just a textbook. Then it's just a history book of what you're reading about. And that's not really why I read fantasy books. So not to say everything should be teach me about the lore, but when you have a nice balance, Paul said the right word. It's the reward that's in there. I get a lot of reward out of learning about a world. And so when I can step out of the adrenaline inducing fight scene and into the unlock the secrets of this awesome fantasy world that I'm in, that I really love those moments. So chapters like this one are some of my favorites.
Trevor, can I add, I feel like what you were looking for in my mind of like this is, I'm not saying this is what you're looking for, but as far as a slow scene that I struggle with, don't like, to put it in perspective, it would be the Rohan scenes of Two Towers, which may ruffle feathers, I don't know. But a lot of the, like, I feel like if you get into kind of more mundane character developments and skirmishes,
mm-hmm.
this is also going to ruffle feathers. I think my example of this may be bridge runs and Shallan chapters of The Way of Kings are not my favorite scenes. More mundane.
The middle third of The Way of Kings?
Yes. Yeah. The middle third of The Way of Kings, precisely. Yeah. where it kind of becomes just normalcy, you know, progression, maybe before a good training arc, you know, I can get behind that. But those moments are more dull. That's kind of off topic, so I didn't mean to bring that up. But that is my moment of not. I don't love it. Not my favorite. So sure. Anyways.
Okay, Elliot. Last book, we got through the entire book without knowing what the title meant. And this book, we get it explained explicitly in the first three chapters. The first part of that, how do you feel about not knowing what Shadows of Self meant? And then Bands of Mourning being explicitly told to you is the Lord Ruler's old metal mines. How do you feel about that?
I actually hopped into our Discord to talk about this just a few days ago because it hit me, and it didn't hit me until I read this chapter where it starts to talk about the Bands of Mourning. I went, oh, wow, there's our title right in chapter three. Wait a second. We never got the title of Shadows of Self. So I had to go a little mini rant in our Discord about that. Or honestly, it was just an honest question. It was like, did I miss it? We talked maybe like two or three episodes before the end of Shadows of Self about what that might mean. And I think I said specifically, I was looking forward to learning what that metaphor might mean. It seemed like it was pointing towards Lessie and the Chondra, and is Wax in love with Lessie, or is it all a manipulation, identity, Shadows of Self, all this kind of stuff. But it was never explained. I feel odd about that. It's a small detail. It shouldn't matter. But for some reason to not have that like specifically talked about when it is in seemingly kind of all the other ones, weird.
Paul, do you have strong feelings? Do you want someone to say the Two Towers in the Two Towers, or do you not care?
Now that it's a theme, I definitely appreciate it. I think it's neat to have the connection of meaning with the title and what it is. I also just thought this was, in particular, a really cool reveal of like ties to the Lord Ruler and all the things there. I thought it was really, really neat and clever, whereas a lot are neat and I like, but it's usually the mention to an in-world book that we may get a quote from but can't read it. I feel like it's a difference in significance. I think this was actually maybe the most significant potentially like title, in-world title reveal, what it is that we've read. And I thought it was really cool. I appreciate it. I think it's neat.
I did I did feel like the lead up to this moment where they get the quest assigned to go seek out the Bands of Mourning, or more specifically to actually go retrieve the other Chondra guy, retrieve Relure's missing spike. If I was to sum up these chapters, it would be new quest unlocked, retrieve Relure's missing spike. This whole setup almost felt like, in a good way, the intro to like a D&D campaign. It was gather our characters who we already know, but need to like circle back up, get the quest assignment from the NPC who knows everything, and head off on the quest to retrieve Relure's missing spike and try and recover the Bands of Mourning along the way. Oh, and by the way, your lost sister is going to get involved as well. It felt very like tabletop RPG for a little bit there.
Yeah, the detail that does actually get Wayne involved, and maybe they intentionally included it, is a evanoscope of Telson, Wax's missing sister. He hasn't seen her in 10 years. She presumably is under captivity of Wax's uncle, is the assumption that we've been led to so far. So that is what actually gets Wax up and involved in this campaign, if as using your word. So main objective, retrieve Relure spike so that he can regain sapience, is the word that we keep using, and tell us where the Bands of Mourning are, hopefully, because he might have seen it, maybe, kind of. He took a picture of them and then claims he had them and then lost them, and then he had his like spike removed, and so he's kind of crazy, but he had this whole crazy story. So there's a whole thing with what happened to Relure. Missing his spike, that's the main objective. Side quest, maybe find the Bands of Mourning. Second side quest, oh, Telson's probably involved, because she just happened to be in the picture that he took of New Saren. She happened to be in the picture of New Saren. So that's kind of how the chapter ends. We get this random chapter 4 that not much. The only thing that happens in it is Wayne is like waltzing through Elendil on the way to Renette's house. Wayne and Renette kind of officially break up, even though they were never together. Wayne just kind of says, okay, you win. I'm not going to pursue you anymore. That was the entirety of chapter 4. I mean, did I miss anything? Was there anything in chapter 4 other than that?
I think Vendel asked Wayne if he can have his skeleton when he's dead, and that was kind of humorous. But that was the entirety of 4. I did want to go back to identity for a little bit and explore that with you guys a touch, because I feel like we learned a lot, but I'm not sure I fully comprehended, or maybe I'm not supposed to yet. And then of course I'm now the gears are spinning on how I connect that to other magic systems in the Cosmere as well. But to kind of dig into it a little bit, we get explained that there's this concept of identity, and it's specifically talked about in the context of Ferrochemy. The line I think that is used to explain it, this is probably Vendel teaching at this point. He says, in Ferrochemy, an individual's investiture is keyed specifically to them. And they talk about this for a little bit. They're like, yeah, Wax, no one else can use your metal mines, right? And he's like, yeah, duh, it's a metal mine. No one else can use it, which I think was a fact that we'd been told before, perhaps. Right. And so this is the magic system explanation for that. There's almost like a DNA code in your investiture. So when you deposit your whatever it is, weight, speed, health into your metal mind, you can't hand that to someone and they use it. Unless you mess with your identity. And this is how apparently the Lord Ruler created the bands of mourning that he was using, and maybe some other interesting bits as well. If you store up your identity in a metal mind, take it out of you, deposit your identity in the metal, then store up something else in a metal mind. Now that speed, let's say, strength, mass or weight, I still haven't figured out which. Then that magic is no longer keyed to your identity because you removed it first. Now anyone can use it. Is that the gist of this and kind of the revelation here of why this is so powerful?
The big pin drop moment is Maracy makes the assumption that any ferrochemist could use it.
Hmm.
But Vendel corrects her and makes the hypothesis that anyone could use it, not just a ferrochemist. And the way he explains it is more specifically anyone of Terrace birth, anyone who has Terrace blood in them could then tap it. Because the way he says it is pretty much everybody has a little bit of Terrace heritage in them. So hypothetically, if there's a unkeyed metal mind, anyone on Scadrial basically could use it, which I think is an important distinction on a follow-up question of, oh, could I take it to Elantris and start tapping weight and mess with stuff? You know, like there's a very big distinction of you have to have Terrace heritage is what Vendel hypothesizes. Now, is that true? I don't know. But the Chondra seem to believe that anyone with Terrace blood in them could tap a unkeyed metal mind, not just a ferrochemist.
Got it. And then we branch over a little bit into Allomancy, because I think it's Vendel still talking again. He references the metal that creates Mistborn from Era 1. Yep. And answers, I think, some questions that we've had of flashback to the Well of Ascension, the book and the place, when Vin and Elend are there. Elend is dying. Vin grabs the leftover metal bead, feeds it to him, and he becomes a Mistborn. That, by all laws of magic that we know in Era 1, that shouldn't be possible.
Right.
But here's the explanation for it. If you've got a magic that has been de-identitied?
Unidentified?
Maybe. I don't know. Whatever that word would be. Then you can bestow it on anyone. So somehow that tied into how that worked of... Elend got access to allomantic power that was not tied to identity somehow, or identity had been messed with in such a way that he was able to connect with it and gain the powers of a Mistborn. I don't know if we quite answered all the questions there, but it at least gives us some things to chew on.
And to contrary my point that I just made, that you have to be of Terrace blood to then use said magic. Hoyd comes walking in and uses that eighth bead before Elend uses the ninth, there's two beads there. Hoyd shows up and uses one, becomes a Mistborn. Like a year later, Elend shows up, uses the last one. So do you have to be of Terrace heritage? I don't know.
Good question. And also, we made a little bit of a logic jump that I didn't quite follow in the story. He says specifically talking about ferrochemy to start with. And they're talking about, well, to make this work, you have to have a total ferrochemist or something. There was a term that they used.
A full ferrochemist. Full. So as far as, well, and there's a, there's an assumption that Wax makes, which they then undo like two paragraphs later. So Wax says, in order to do this, you'd have to have someone that is full Pharaoh Chemist and full Mistborn in order to start de-identifying yourself and then filling metal mines.
Right.
But what's the catch that Vendel says? Well, that's not the only way to become a Pharaoh Chemist or an Allomancer, which is when Hemallergy comes into this discussion.
Right. But then so we're talking mainly about Ferrochemy to start with, as we're talking about identity and all this kind of stuff, what the Lord Ruler was doing. But then when he jumps over to this bead from Era One that Elend and Hoyt apparently got Mistborn powers from, we just jumped from Ferrochemy to Allomancy. So things like you're talking about with the caveat of Terra's heritage, does all that still apply when you shift over to Allomancy? It was unclear to me. But yeah, lots of good things to chew on for a kind of a new, it's not really a new magic system necessarily, or maybe it is, but it's a new type of way we can interact with human beings via investiture powered magic.
I'm very puzzled at the moment, just trying to piece all of it together. The one thing that I do feel like I have an answer to is that I don't think you have to be Terrace for it to work, because I mean, Hoyt is essentially everything, it seems, but my understanding is Terrace is fairly like, isn't it fairly like biological, like you're a Terrace right. person?
Yeah, it's a so people like, group from the north of Skadrial.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm pretty sure we know that Hoyt is not natively that, so
right,
that's the one thing that I'm like, I think that's the case. Aside from that, I'll need time to kind of mull over a lot of this.
I feel like Trevor, you told us about this not long ago, and it's becoming very, very, very true. The types of convoluted questions you can start to ask yes. when you learn about enough of the Cosmere gets pretty crazy. And yeah. so on things like the spoiler Q&As that Brandon does when people come up with these absolutely absurd combinations of different magic systems that end up being actually very fascinating and interesting questions, because there's so many different ways these can all interact. We're very much in that territory. So when you say things, Paul, like, I know Hoyt's not Terrace, so he shouldn't be able to do that, I immediately start to go, well, but hang on a second. We're talking about manipulating your identity. What's to say he can't like take on an identity that's not his somehow via the use of another type of magic system like breaths or something like that?
What if he soul stamps himself to be Terrace?
Oh, yeah.
And I did.
Absolutely.
I did think of soul stamps right away when I was reading this, and I'm disappointed that I didn't recall that thus far until you mentioned it. Of soul stamps, I'm like, I think that gets really rocky really quick mm-hmm. with identity yeah. and soul stamps and all this stuff, because I mean,
or what if you divested yourself of identity and then bonded a spren? Then what happens? Has the spren then bonded to nothing and anyone could use said powers? What does that even mean? I don't know.
Yep. Identity has just unlocked a whole new realm of questions to be asked.
Or could you bond multiple sprens with divesting yourself of identity? I don't know. Yeah, there's some Cosmere keys being unlocked here. Anything else from that discussion? We talked about... So the Bands of Mourning, you guys hypothesized that it could be... what's her name? Before knowing it was the Lord Ruler's metal mines, you hypothesized that it could be Tyndall's metal mines.
Yes.
Paul, that's a theory that you came up with.
Yes. Yeah. I remember that mostly based off of the relevance of, you know, Tyndall and Sazed.
Right.
On it, obviously, but...
So, do you guys think that that they mention Sazed's metal mines in this chapter. They talk about the bands of mourning. They talk about the spear of or the lance of the fountains. The lance of the fountains is what's brought up. Do you guys know what that is?
Nope. Maybe I should.
The Lady Mistborn's knives. That one's pretty obvious. But the lance of the fountains is the spear that Kelsier uses in like the square of Luthadel to spear the Lord Ruler. They call it the Lance of the Fountains because there's a bunch of like, it's like a city square. It's got fountains and stuff in it.
It was kind of neat hearing like I was expecting to just hear the Bands of Mourning, and then we kind of get a list of like all these to them, all these like artifacts, I guess, which aside from the Bands of Mourning, I feel like most of them are pretty normal items that are probably just like, you know.
One of my favorite ones actually,
history, you know,
is Wayne references the Testimony of Hammond. Like it's a holy scripture. I thought that was so funny. Like he's reading Hammond, like the letter to the church, Hammond. And I was like, that is so funny that Brandon put that in there, that the, you know, the original crew have like holy books that were written down from their words. I think it's such a like cool and niche and an interesting like inclusion to the Cosmere.
That was very funny. And also it was a totally like uncouth, totally just ridiculous quote, I believe. I don't remember what it was exactly, but I remember a really ridiculous, like unhinged quote followed by from the Book of Hammond.
Right. That
was funny.
And it all just goes along with the Imperial language of like the Wuzzing script that's Les de Mortis uses, and they just hold that as ceremonious.
Or the other drop we got, other references, Vendel apparently has literally Breeze's hands.
Yes.
Like actual Breeze from 300 years ago. Vendel knew him, found him, dug him up, and incorporated his hands into his skeleton. Or whatever. The dude's like a collector of people.
Yeah.
Bones.
And he's like, weird. Wow, I literally just shook Breeze's hand.
Yeah.
Like that's so ridiculous. That was one of those details that I'm like, you know, that was neat, I suppose, but I was not prepared, and nor do I think that was particularly necessary, I guess.
Don't know how I feel about ridiculous. That.
Yeah, exactly. That was very funny.
Anything else, gentlemen?
That's all I got.
All right. Between the other two that were not specifically touched on, Fortune and Connection, which one do you guys want to slideshow on next between Fortune and Connection?
I would like Fortune. Pretty hands down.
I would also like Fortune.
Connection is, I feel like, maybe more important to our Ultimate Stormlight story, because we've seen it a good bit. But because we've seen it a good bit, I feel like I have a good general-ish, you know, bearing on Connection.
I think we may get one of these scenes on Connection in Wind and Truth, because Dalinar's entire like magic system has to do with Connection, like specifically. And manipulating Connection between people. So what little we do know on Connection, I think, will be explored more in Stormlight 5. Fortune, on the other hand, we know that Hoid has it, and it puts him where he's supposed to be. And that's it. That's all we know.
I think if Fortune, hopefully I'm remembering this right, I think Fortune came up in a somewhat early Taravangian scene as well.
Yeah.
So there's something else going on with Fortune as well. I too would love the Fortune 101 class, because I think we've been in Connection 101 class. I need more Fortune.
Anything else from this episode, gentlemen?
Or memory. I might need the memory class too.
Yeah, memory, I'm still wishy-washy on if that's actually a mechanic of magic or if that's kind of just Shallan being weird. All right, let's do a Stormlight review. It's been a couple weeks since we've done one of these, so you guys are going to have to pivot into a Stormlight brain. To catch you guys up, Elliot is leading by 10-6, the widest lead gap he's had yet. And Elliot is going to lead this. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
As of this weekend, as of recording this, we are almost exactly 6 months out of Wind and Truth releasing. So here we go. Elliot, your chapter name, give me a brief summary of what happened in said chapter of a Stormlight book. Your chapter name is Art and Expectation.
I'm immediately thinking of a rather detailed discussion that we had during Words of Radiance about these topics, but I'm a little skeptical of whether the title chapter, which I'm really bad about paying attention to those, actually lined up with the topic that we were discussing. But I'm going to go with it. This is a chapter where Shallan draws pictures of plants while they're traveling to the Shattered Plains, and she has high expectations for these mercenaries that she's partnered up with. It's either mercenaries or the deserters, and she, because she has high expectations, inspires them to noble deeds.
Good guess, but incorrect. Paul?
Well, that was pretty much going to be my guess, what Elliot said. I was thinking of the chapter where Elliot draws, you know, Gaz and the other crew members there.
Where Elliot draws Gaz?
Yes, where Elliot draws Gaz and the crew members. So where Shallan,
you don't want to see me draw anything.
Sorry, where Shallan draws them and kind of a greater likeness of them, I guess, and it's kind of inspirational, kind of sets them in a better image. If that's not the case, though, I'll just pull one out of left field. Art in Expectation, you said, right? I'm going to say that this is the chapter where they get the new... My second guess is that it's the chapter where the Parshendi get their new form, the one that I couldn't remember the name of, and it destroyed me last Stormlight review, and I'm still struggling
to remember the name. Envoy form.
Envoy form, which is not exactly better art form, but sort of like better art form in my brain. So I'm going to go with that when they get envoy form.
Incorrect. And actually, I was corrected by one of our viewers on that question that you're talking about. They specifically don't have art form. They use nimble form as a substitute for art form, which is why they can't do art. But anyway, Art and Expectation is in Words of Radiance. You were both correct about that. It is the epilogue of Words of Radiance, where Wit is waiting for Jasnah on the other side of the perpendicularity that she comes through.
And probably lecturing a rock or something like he always does.
That's exactly what he's doing. He's lecturing a Kremling, which could feasibly be a sleepless, about Art and Expectation.
Well, I never would have gotten that. So
if there's ever art in the title, I wonder if this is actually true. Because the epilogue for Rhythm of War is great art. The epilogue for Oathbringer is... No. The epilogue for Oathbringer is great art. The epilogue for Rhythm of War is... Dirty Tricks. Because Odium tricks him. But anyway. So I disproved my little art theory. Paul... Your quote ID, who's talking from a Stormlight book? This is a magnificent creation. Do you think it could be used to quickly deliver a mobile hospital staffed with surgeons to a battlefield?
Okay, I'm going to need you to say it one more time.
This is a magnificent creation. Do you think it could be used to deliver a mobile hospital staffed with surgeons to a battlefield?
I just have to know who says this.
Who's talking?
Oh my gosh. I have like 8 names in my head. I'm just going to pick one that I feel like would maybe say this. Because I think I know the scene. I just don't remember who all is involved in this scene. Okay. Can you read it for me one more time? Apologies.
This is a magnificent creation. Do you think it could be used to quickly deliver a mobile hospital staffed with surgeons to a battlefield?
I'm going to say that this is Renarin speaking.
Incorrect. Elliot, would you like a shot?
Of course. I think this is one of the Stormblessed family. Is Kaladin and his family have a last name? I think it's just Stormblessed. I'm just deciding now it's Stormblessed. So this is either Father Stormblessed or Son Stormblessed. And I think it's Father. I think this is Lirin.
You are correct. It is Lirin. And it's funny you talk about the last name, because Dalinar's response is an ingenious application, though edge dancers generally do that job now. And right after that, Dalinar calls him Father Stormblessed.
Oh, really?
And Lirin's like, excuse me, what? And Dalinar says, oh, I'm sorry. I just thought you'd take your son's house name. And so Kaladin does officially have a house name of Stormblessed by Rhythm of War, but that is news to Lirin on this scene when the fourth bridge shows up in Hearthstone and rescues everybody.
I thought I was being facetious. I completely forgot about the fact that that's actually his name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
It does Elliot. Make sense that Lirin would be the one preoccupied with, oh, can you put surgeons on this? You know,
right. And Lirin actually has a bit of an identity crisis at the beginning of Rhythm of War, because he learns about edge dancers and how they kind of just heal everybody instantly. And he's like, I'm irrelevant now. But
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, Elliot, your review of a Cosmere book. What did they rate it, and what book is it? This took me a while to get to, but I finally did. And of course, I loved it. Although, they really need to do something about this cover. Shows a picture of the cover. That's a pretty awful cover. Or illustration? Question mark? Or whatever the crap that is. I don't know why that comes up on Goodreads. Sigh, patiently waiting for the next one.
I don't feel like I'm an expert on cover art, which I need to be in order to answer this review. Let's see. These are weighted towards Stormlight, but can go elsewhere. That's your rule on these?
Correct. Heavily weight, like 9 out of 10 weighted towards Stormlight, but feasibly could be something else you have read.
I've talked about this briefly in probably the long past in early Stormlight books. I'm not immediately taken in by the Stormlight cover art. It doesn't scream unique to me. I feel like there's a lot of fantasy books out there that have very similar type covers. But after reading the books and learning what the art is about, I look back on those covers very fondly and enjoy them a lot. So to really call out one of those, who's the artist? He's a famous artist.
Michael Whalen, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds right. To rag on his art, that doesn't seem to make sense. Again, not that logic is the best guide on answering these questions. So now I'm racking my brain on like Mistborn covers and other things. You know what? I'm talking for too long. I'm giving Paul too many clues. I think I'm just going to go kind of completely out of left field and say this is Elantris.
And a rating.
Oh. 4 out of 5.
Okay. 4 out of 5 for Elantris. Over to Paul.
I think this, I'm going to say my answer and then I'll briefly say why. I think this is a 5 out of 5 for Oathbringer. I don't know how old. Oh, also, before I actually solidify that, can I ask, this is confirmed, like, English, like, American covers, right?
No.
Am I like, oh, it's not. Is that just you can't confirm, or it is not?
I refuse to give you that information.
Okay. So that was my question, because it's different, you know, all the different
things.
I'm going to assume it is. I'm going under that assumption. I personally am most underwhelmed by the Way of Kings cover art, actually, of the four we have right now. But I don't think this is the Way of Kings. If they've waited for it and if they're waiting for the next one, but they reviewed it on Goodreads, I feel like it's a bit more recent than the Way of Kings release. So I'm going with Oathbringer because I think it's not the most beautiful, overwhelming cover art. The logic in me says it's not Words of Radiance or Rhythm of War, because I think those have cool cover arts, but logic is always betraying us. Anyways, I'm just going to stick with my gut, Oathbringer. I think they really liked the book, though, are anxiously awaiting the next, so I'm giving it 5 out of 5.
Okay. This review was written in May of 2017. It is a 5 out of 5 for Edge Dancer.
They complain about the cover art of Edge Dancer. Isn't it just the Edge Dancer symbol and that's it?
It is now. It was not at the time. Oh, so Edge Dancer was released with this. I don't even know how to describe it. I can. Here, I'll paste this for you guys. I'll put it up on screen for our YouTube viewers. That's not working. Hold on. You can just Google Edge Dancer cover.
I was going to say, I could probably just find that. Yeah.
It's not coming up. Oh, there it is. So Edge Dancer was originally released with this cover, and that is what they are talking about.
Okay, I kind of get it now. That's really not the best cover art for such a book. Anyways.
I've seen worse.
Yeah.
All right. So that is 1 point to Paul. You guys are at 1-1. Paul, this goes to you. Your general trivia question. Who kills Ele Sadeus?
Adolin Colin. Final answer?
Incorrect. Adolin Colin kills Toril Sadeus.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Elliot, would you like to answer this?
This is where she like gets stabbed with poison and Shallan is like super confused about who did the stabbing with the poison and has to try and figure it out and ultimately figured out that it was... See, now I'm second-guessing myself about the details of all this, because it's a very confusing time for Shallan back in these stories, where we're trying to figure out who did what, and Shallan does stuff, and then later learns that Shallan did the things, and then we discover she's got these multiple identities going on, which maybe is what you're fishing for with this answer, is like which identity of Shallan did the killing. Now I'm overthinking it. I'm going to just say it is Shallan, and if you want something more specific, I think it's like, you know what? I'm going to stop digging and just say Shallan.
Can you be more specific?
See, I knew you were going to say that. So this is like, now I have to process more. I want to say, like, it's a very veil thing to do, right? So it's like veil does that kind of thing. But I feel like this was like part of the story where that didn't actually match up. And this was like one of the early acts, like very first acts that we noticed as readers of Radiant. And this was like the first time Radiant had come out and done something like to save the day for Shallan by making the kill. So I Vale. I'm really gonna kick myself if it's Radiant.
You are incorrect.
No.
And I'm not gonna give it to you. It is Radiant.
No.
And she does not tell Shallan or Vale. She does it to protect them from the Ghost Bloods, because the Ghost Bloods want ELA Sadeas captured alive, and Radiant is specifically not part of the Ghost Bloods, but Vale and Shallan are. So Radiant takes over and kills her before the Ghost Bloods can get a hold of her. All that to say, yes, Shallan is going through a little bit in Rhythm of War.
I should have stuck with my gut, because I knew it, dang it.
I just want to, I guess, try to mend the wound that I'm feeling right now of... I'm even rereading The Way of Kings, and I know his name is Toral Sadeas, but you hear Sadeas, and you instantly think of Sadeas, sure. You know? And so I was like, there's no way this question is this easy. But last time I thought that, I overthought myself and was wrong. So, anyways.
All right. No points, because we did not get the correct persona of Shallan. But it will remain 10-6. Thanks for joining me this week, Paul and Elliot.
Wait, did we tie?
Yes, 1-1.
Yes, because I got 5 out. I slid through with my 5 out.
Oh,
five
you got the 5 out of 5. Okay. Yeah.
And so I'm sliding through this.
Here we go. Good. On to next week.
Bye.